when I work in the COVID positive unit, there seems to be enough face masks. So N95 surgical masks and hoods. I'm not sure how long that will last.
It really is far reaching and trying to address as fully as possible the economic impacts of the pandemic.
This is Emily Munson, Washington correspondent for the Albany Times Union. Welcome to a special edition of the Capitol Confidential podcast. Last week, President Donald Trump signed into law what's being called the largest economic stimulus bill in U.S. history to respond to the unprecedented coronavirus epidemic gripping our nation. Congress negotiated and approved this $2 trillion bipartisan bill in one whirlwind week. This is the third coronavirus response bill Congress has passed. Congressman Paul Tonko has represented New York's Capital Region since 2009, and he joins us now to discuss the relief this legislation aims to bring to the Albany area. So I'm here with Congressman Paul Tonko. How are you today, Congressman?
I'm doing well, and I hope you're well. It's great to join you, Emily.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. So we're here to discuss the Phase 3 coronavirus stimulus bill that was passed by Congress last week and signed by President Donald Trump. This bill contains direct cash assistance for many Americans. Individuals making less than $75,000 a year will receive $1,200 plus $500 per child. And I know a lot of our readers are wondering, when should they expect to receive this cash assistance from the legislation? Can you describe when people should see this aid?
Well, I think that basically they're fast at work already. We're hoping the Treasury Department and IRS announced that distribution of economic impact payments will begin in the next 3 weeks. And I would just remind all those joining us that they'll be delivered automatically by the IRS to most Americans who file individual federal income tax returns. And then also to remind people that the rebates do not need to be repaid, they're not counted as taxable income, and will not affect eligibility for public programs. So I think all of that is important information to share, but hopefully a matter of weeks for those who, again, are associated somehow with the IRS system. For those that don't file, there will be other guidelines that will get them their check, and basically the outreach will be done by IRS and Social Security also, which will try to connect people with their Social Security numbers.
Another key part of this bill is the expanded unemployment benefits. Unfortunately, we're seeing that a lot of Americans are losing their jobs right now due to the outbreak. A record 3.3 million Americans filed for unemployment claims with the U.S. Department of Labor last week. And those numbers are unfortunately expected to rise. But you included expanded unemployment benefits in this Phase 3 legislation. Can you describe for me, please, who is now eligible for federal unemployment aid and how much they should expect to receive compared to their normal unemployment aid?
Yeah, well, Emily, let me stress that the CARES Act really puts families first. And that's the overall theme in this effort. So the effort through unemployment insurance benefits is to provide an additional $600 per week in federally funded benefits for those laid off workers. That will run through July of 2020. And then an additional 13 weeks of emergency unemployment coverage for those who have exhausted regular benefits. The $600 per week will ensure pretty much that the average worker will receive 100% of his or her lost wages. So again, it's to keep those families intact. But the legislation provides also for funding to states to temporarily expand eligibility for unemployment assistance to self-employed individuals, those who are independent contractors, the gig economy employees, and individuals who were unable to start a new job or contract due to the pandemic. So they may have had a contract in place, the pandemic stopped that, and so they'll be eligible. So it really is far-reaching and trying to address as fully as possible the economic impacts of the pandemic.
Wow. Do you think some of those expansions of unemployment assistance to gig workers and self-employed people, do you expect that that might become a permanent change after this?
You know, it might. It might be an exercise, a scenario that teaches us, instructs us that perhaps this is a kinder, more benign approach to address those who might require assistance when they run into hard times. So, you know, the New York State Department of Labor will be running the program as it does traditionally. And I think we'll probably get a lot of feedback from the department as to, you know, what the new context is all about and how it's working.
Let's also talk about what this bill will do for small businesses who are employing these workers. You know, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle really stressed to me in interviews that helping Main Street was their top priority in crafting this legislation. So how does the bill incentivize small and mid-sized businesses to stay open and to keep employees on the payroll?
Well, it certainly recognizes those small businesses as the heartbeat of our economy. And again, many of these are mom and pop operations, family businesses. So again, it speaks to the family first concept from the employer perspective. But the CARES Act establishes that Paycheck Protection Program, which provides cash flow assistance through 100% federally guaranteed loans to small businesses and not-for-profits who maintain their payroll during this emergency. So if employers maintain that payroll, the loans would be forgiven, which would help workers remain employed as well as help the affected small businesses. So it's a win-win outcome. There are features such as forgiveness of up to 8 weeks of payroll based on employee retention and salary levels. Those are both important. But there'll be also no SBA fees. And then there's other concepts with as much as 6 months of deferral with the maximum deferrals of up to a year. So the Paycheck Protection Program is intended as a cash flow bridge, if you will, to help small businesses retain employees. Now, if a small business is in need of immediate cash, they can choose rather to go to the Emergency Economic Injury Grant Program that can provide up to $10,000. And those are going to be available through the SBA's website, Emily.
And is that where most small businesses should turn for information about these loans and support?
They can do that. Or let me tell you, our office has been dealing with several requests. We're into the hundreds that people have called our office, and we're directing them as best we can. And if there are questions that are really into the nitty-gritty of detail, we'll direct them to the appropriate resources. But we can field quite a bit of the questions that they might have.
Let's also discuss what this bill will do for larger corporations. The legislation includes up to $500 billion in loans for large corporations. And I'm hoping that you can compare and contrast the aid provided to large corporations in this bill with the supports that were offered to large companies back in 2009, which was when the last large stimulus package was passed by Congress. And you actually voted in favor of both of those bills. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts as you reflect on the two.
Yeah, in fact, it was my freshman term in Congress when we were deep in the woes of recession, and that settled most deeply in March of 2009. With the stimulus, with this stimulus, significant portion goes to average American workers and families, far more so than with the 2009 package, which was focused primarily on large corporations and the banks. Remember, the financial sector was near collapse. So the turnaround on the package was far quicker with this one because of the coronavirus stimulus. And basically, the restrictions on large corporations weren't as plentiful. I think there were lessons learned from that last package. You know, I'm not about providing a taxpayer bailout for corporations where they may leverage some stock reauthorization or provide management bonuses while the employees go without. So this one provides incentives to businesses to keep their workers. And it's a larger stimulus because of the double-fisted attack here of a war against the coronavirus and a war against a crumbling economy because of the virus. So it's $1 trillion larger with a $2 trillion outcome.
Wow, that's quite a bit bigger. And a significant part of this aid that we have not talked about yet is going to hospitals and health centers. I believe it's about $100 billion to help these facilities pay their bills, pay their workers, buy the supplies they need, including personal mm-hmm. protective equipment, and also pay for coronavirus research. And, you know, we're hearing about the struggles of hospitals and health centers all over the country to get the supplies that they need and keep their workers safe. How do you ensure that this funding will address this problem that is so severe right now?
Right. We're hearing a lot of satisfaction from the hospitals that this $100 billion approach in the stimulus package was included. It obviously provides for procurement of much needed PPE, the personal protective equipment, the masks, the gowns, very, very important in terms of protecting our frontliners. We see now of the drastic numbers of those who have been infected by the virus that are frontline workers. It helps them with retrofitting facilities and certainly with workforce, increasing workforce and training. There was a portion that we wanted to get into this measure that dealt with OSHA to protect workers, and that was denied in the negotiations. We worked very hard from the caucus perspective, from the Democratic perspective in the House to get OSHA protections, but that wasn't allowed. So hopefully in the next go around, we can do that. But I think these dollars will be very much welcomed and very effectively utilized to protect the workers. This is about, there were steps here that were taken. There was emergency, obviously, with the test outcome. And now, moving forward with mitigation, making certain that we have the workers protected and that the patients are getting responded to. And then we will go forward with recovery.
You know, lastly, this bill also contained aid for state governments and local governments. And this was something that drew the remark of Governor Andrew Cuomo last week, who said the state aid was not nearly enough. New York was allocated about $5.1 billion, and then pots of several million dollars were allocated to New York's counties and counties all around the country. And so I'm wondering if you think in this next package that you're working on, that we'll discuss further, does there need to be more supports for state and local governments?
Well, yes, absolutely. We're going to work to increase the assistance. At least I will push very hard for our states and localities. I think, all governments are looking at really tough times here. So I think from our small cities to the largest to state governments, there needs to be assistance here, and certainly for the counties. But to the appropriations that were made, there were many who wanted maintenance of efforts. So there was language attached to the FMAP, the Medicaid contributions to the states. And while we did very well with that appropriation, the attached language restricted any cuts to Medicaid or reforms. And so I think with a fourth and perhaps fifth supplemental package in the works, we'll be able to address the efforts again, and hopefully in a way that will respond to better outcomes as they relate to reforms that some of the states may want to insert.
Now, lastly here, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters yesterday that one of her priorities for the next coronavirus stimulus bill is even more direct cash assistance for Americans. And tell me, what other measures would you like to see in this fourth package? We've touched on aid for state and local governments. We've touched on OSHA protections for workers. That's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration that oversees worker regulation. What are your top priorities for this fourth coronavirus bill?
Well, basically, you know, while we've made a major stride forward and we're very successful in getting that testing appropriation, and still, you know, it's getting the money out the door. I keep hearing about the lack of testing kits and moving them through the evaluation process quicker. So we want to stay on top of that. If we need to insert language to do that, that would be helpful. But after the testing comes treatment. And if people cannot afford the hospital care, then we need to be there in that response. I think that is an investment that keeps all of us safer by ensuring that symptomatic individuals don't continue to spread coronavirus in the community. I think that there's a need for even stronger checks on money for corporations. We need to make certain that there isn't this taxpayer bailout, and then we see a huge layoff of employees. That would be a failure. This is about responding to families first. And then finally, I think this is an important opportunity, an important challenge that faces us to respond to underpinning our economy and stamping out the coronavirus, the COVID-19 threat. The way we can do that also, and to respond to, you know, greening up our agenda, is to build infrastructure from roads to bridges to ports and airports and broadband, modernizing the electric grid and water infrastructure. I think all of that would be important. It would keep people in the work mode. It would provide for essential projects to be get done. And it would be done, Emily, at a time when we can take advantage of zero or negative interest rates. So it allows us to create jobs quickly, modernize our aging infrastructure, green up the sustainability portions of it, and take advantage of the interest rates as they currently exist.
Well, there's so much to discuss here about this $2 trillion bill, but I think we'll leave it there for today. So, Congressman, I want to thank you for your time. We appreciate you joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure, Emily, and thank you for the work you do for the Capital Region with your position down in Washington. You do a great job, and it's always fun to interact with you.
Thanks so much. All right, we'll be talking to you soon.
Stay tuned. Next on the Capital Confidential podcast, State Editor Brendan Lyons touches base with a nurse on the front lines of the COVID-19 outbreak.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
This is Brendan Lyons, state editor with the Times Union in Albany. As New York City hospitals became overwhelmed with critically ill COVID-19 patients this week, leading officials to transfer many of those patients to upstate hospitals, including Albany Medical Center, Capital Confidential sat down for an online chat with Amy Lee Patchock, a critical care nurse at Stony Brook Hospital on Long Island, which has been one of the nation's hotspots for the infectious disease.
The situation since coronavirus erupted, how has it changed? You know, even over the last 2 weeks or since we last spoke?
I believe that what they're attempting to do, what the university hospital is attempting to do, is to divert people unless they're super sick from coming to the ER. So they have these field lots. So I do know that. So I know the most sick people are coming to the ER. So what we have seen upstairs is that we've had an increase in our need for ventilators, like super crazy. We've created 3 new ICUs, and that in itself is sort of insane if you really think about that. Fortunately for Stony Brook, or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, they ended up moving some units that were in the towers to a new building that they called the Pavilion. And when they moved them to the new building, nothing really has been put in the old units. So they were able to access those old units and make them ICUs. They're all full.
This is much different, I take it, than when you get flu patients who come in, you know, with the annual flu. I know some of them can be very ill too, but I talked to one nurse who was on the front lines in New Rochelle, and she said the thing that stuck out in her mind was the difficulty breathing of the patients. And, it, you know, is that a real trademark of this infectious disease?
What we see in these patients is that they're breathing, talking, they come in complaining of shortness of breath, and then all of a sudden they can't breathe. It escalates that quickly. And then we just titrate up their oxygen until they need to be intubated, unless that they're clearly hypoxic on admission, then they get intubated immediately.
And are you seeing some of the, I won't attempt to say the name of the drug, but the new drug that they're talking about, the malaria drug that's had some success with the Z-Pak, and are they trying that at Stony Brook at this point?
Stony Brook is like sort of cutting edge, to be honest with you. Like, their slogan is the best ideas in medicine, and they really try and do what's best. So whatever the standard is, whatever the evidence says, is something that they always follow, specifically in this sort of situation. All of the patients are getting the what has been recommended. They're getting the malaria drug, as you call it. They're getting azithromycin. And I believe they're all getting ascorbic acid or vitamin C.
Is it having some success in treating their symptoms?
Yes. Does it probably help? Yes, it probably does. But when you look at their ABGs, arterial blood gases, we can still see that these people are acidotic, that their PCO2 is intermittently elevated, that their PO2, their oxygen levels are incredibly low, lower than baseline, lower than like COPDers. So it's crazy.
The governor is continuing to say the apex is still 7 to 21 days away, so they don't know when it will hit. How are you doing, Stony Brook? How is the hospital doing in ICU in terms of its supply of beds and ventilators and even protective equipment? Is there everything you need, at least at this point?
In terms of ventilators, I'm not sure how much or how many we have. I do know that we did get a unique kind of ventilator that we put people who were not having the COVID on, that were more chronic vent patients. We switched over their ventilators. So in terms of PPE, like when I work in the COVID positive unit, there seems to be enough face masks. So N95, surgical masks, and hoods. I'm not sure how long that will last. When I've talked to colleagues who work outside of that realm, I was talking to somebody who works in like the mother baby world, because believe it or not, it's already in the mother baby world too, like LND, postpartum, you know, mommies are coming in and they have the COVID and they, you know, their baby is a rule out as soon as they're born, right? So one of the nurses in that area said that they felt like there weren't enough masks for them and they didn't have their proper size. When asked for the mask that she was fit tested for, she was told that there was less than a week's supply left of that. So from what I understand, according to this individual, supposedly they were going to ask the governor's office for more masks. In terms of gowns, you know, when you look at the people from the healthcare professionals from Italy and China, our get up is not the same. They have like hazmat suits on, if you will. Okay. We literally have on a plastic gown, it is covering the front of us. You know, we have our mask, and then some people have a shield, some people wear glasses, and everybody wears a bouffant. So that's sort of like the baseline here where we're practicing. I think in New York City, it's actually less because they don't have really anything.
Do you guys feel safe? Or is your protective equipment adequate to you know?
No, because we're not following the standards. The standards state that you should have a different mask for each patient. The standards state that if you get your mask dirty or moist, so you should switch it. So our current policy at Stony Brook is if your mask is dirty, switch it. If the COVID aerosolizes, means goes into the air, you have to throw out all your equipment because then it's on you. So I don't know if there's adequate equipment, because the other day, one of my colleagues, when we were working on the positive unit, had to go scavenge up gowns because there were like none left on the unit that I was working. I don't know what that means. I don't know if we're going to run out soon. I do know that a couple of people bought like hefty garbage bags just in case we don't have the gowns to cover your person.
And this isn't like a bus crash where they come through and there's a flood of patients. This just doesn't stop, it seems. How's morale in dealing with that for you guys, where the waves like from a hurricane just keep coming and coming and coming?
So you have to, first of all, the first day that you're on a unit like this, you're kind of afraid in general because it's something that you've never experienced before. So there's nerves the first day, right? And then by the second day, you're like, oh, okay. So you first of all have to accept your role. What is your role? Your role is to get these people on airway. It's to drop lines so they can get the drugs that they need. It's to put in Foleys. It's to make sure that everything's adequate, that you line everything up, and then you just treat them. So your goal is just to save them. I will say that the team dynamics are pretty amazing. The way in which we're working together is amazing. We're coming together and trying to like solve the problem because we realize how dire it is. And it's hard to do what we're doing, but there's nothing like camaraderie in the workplace.
I know PEF is one of the unions that was putting up people, you know, getting blocks of hotel rooms because, you know, even the governor said, some nurses and other healthcare workers, they're afraid to go home to their families. They're afraid to infect their families.
Right.
You know, because you don't show symptoms for a few days, right? And be home.
I'm staying in a hotel currently. If I wasn't put up by PEF, then I would probably rent an Airbnb or a VRBO. I know some of my colleagues already have. They had rented before PEF offered the rooms because of dynamics in their house.
It must be hard on these patients too, because they can't have visitors. They can't see their family. You know, it's not as though your spouse can be next to you at your bedside holding your hand saying, hang in there. They're going through this largely alone, aren't they?
Absolutely. Sure. You know, in the beginning of this whole coronavirus, we already knew that that was happening. So you would see some people post things on social media saying like, oh, you'll die alone. Nobody will be there with you. You know, we'll be there with you. Your healthcare provider will be there with you. But it's not like I know your story. I only know like why you're here. I know your past medical history. It's not like when I meet you, it's not like I ever had a conversation with you. It's not like I talked to your spouse or your partner or your cousin or your children to figure out what your story was when I can get to the phone, because that is really the truth when I can get to the phone. I can't always talk to people on the phone because we are that busy that we ourselves aren't even like taking breaks to have drinks or eat food. So what happened this weekend and I thought was really nice is that one of the trauma coordinators came up and rounded with our attendings, and she called all the family members to update them. She would talk to them about whatever they wanted, find out who they were. She made signs and stuff for these people from their family, stating, giving messages to them. So the nurse, when I went in the room, I talked to my patient, about what his life was, about who was at home, what his children were saying to him. I will tell you that I'm not sure if he heard me or if he understood, because this patient was heavily sedated and we're giving them medications to keep them down. And the reason we do that is because the vent settings are so strong that it's really uncomfortable for them. But the truth is that they are isolated. They have contact with healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, aides, respiratory therapists, you know, so it's a life of isolation, you know, all the way around. Healthcare professionals are isolating themselves. Patients are isolating themselves. The public should be isolating themselves.
No. And let me ask you, I mean, this is just from your perspective, I guess, your opinion, did the state respond quickly enough? Knowing what we know now, even the governor said this week, you know, we've been behind this virus. We underestimated it. And it looks now as though it may have been here much earlier than they knew and spreading.
I think they did what they did when they did it because the public wasn't really presenting with symptoms. When you don't see it, right? You don't see it. You just sort of let it go. But then as it started to present itself, you know, frankly, Governor Cuomo started to act. He's doing the right thing now. Maybe if he started a little bit sooner, but if you've never been presented with such a crisis in your entire life, right, it's hard to just do that and make people transition.
Well, Amy, we thank you so much for joining us, and everyone, please stay tuned to thetimesunion.com, and we'll continue covering the coronavirus pandemic, and we will stay in touch with people on the front lines of this war, as the governor has called it, including Amy, who is in the middle of that war as we speak. Thanks so much, Amy. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.